This is Chris Bacon, composer for Bates Motel, and you're listening to Good Evening.
Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. This is episode number 10. Tonight we're talking about Downhill from 1927, the American release titled When Boys Leave Home. And joining us, as always, Brandon Shimatala here in Regina, Saskatchewan. Brandon, say hi.
Yeah, you can just call me Captain of the Rugby team.
Captain Rugby. Chris Haig, all the way from the United Kingdom.
Hello.
And our special guest tonight, Brandy Jackla from Ogden, Utah.
Hello.
So, Brandy, for the viewers and the listeners who don't know you, tell us a bit about yourself, please.
Oh, golly. How much time do we have? I'm such an interesting person.
30 seconds.
Well, I'm a geek and a nerd and all of those fun things, and it's a great time to be a nerd. I do a podcast with my husband. I do some stuff on Trek FM. I like to do improv comedy in my free time, and I also have done some theater, but that's getting way too hard and as far as time for rehearsals and stuff, because I'm just too busy, guys. Just too busy.
So, Brandy, what is your experience with Mr. Hitchcock?
Well, the first movie that I remember seeing was Rear Window when I was probably 5,
right,
maybe 6. And I think the next one that I saw after that was Psycho, which I'm surprised my parents let me watch that. And I think I was about 7 at that time. And that one I actually found really interesting. But, yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like, oh, it's a Hitchcock movie. I'm in. Let's go.
Right on.
Let's do this.
Well, you'll fit in well in this group then as a fan of the master. I have a quick round table question before we get into the show. We are recording this on the weekend of Halloween. And question for the group here. We'll go one at a time. What is your favorite Hitchcock film to watch at Halloween, Brandon?
Ooh, geez. I would have to say, you know, it just for spookiness factor and stuff, I mean, it's got to be Psycho. I mean, like, that's, I think, the scariest movie that he made.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
What about you, Chris?
Do you know, weirdly, we were talking about this in a different podcast thing that came up. So, you've got Psycho and everything. I sort of think, though, The Birds is scarier because you can't rationalize the birds, they're just attacking and they're just all, you know, it's that kind of insane, no stopping it sort of thing. And it has a super bleak ending. So,
Brandy?
That's a good choice.
What would your choice be for your favorite Hitchcock film for watching Halloween weekend?
Ooh, well, when I was younger, it used to be Psycho, but as a grown person, it is Vertigo. Probably because I have an inner ear imbalance and I get vertigo. And so I really identify with that sensation. And it's one of those movies where even at the end, you're just not sure what to believe. So I enjoy that. It's a good suspense film.
I would have to say Birds also. Birds is also one of the more fun movies for costumes. One of the Hitchcock parties that we had at our house in the last few years, a friend showed up and she was kind of dressed, you know, with the bird sitting on the corner of her glasses frame, you know, like perched there. And we had a lot of fun. We served bird seed to the crowd that showed up at our house. We had a bird feeder full of trail mix, peanuts and raisins and chocolates and stuff. So I think Birds is a fun party film and it's a fun costume film. And it's a scary film. Definitely a good horror film for Halloween. Now let's move on with the show. Let's go over to Chris. Chris, I believe you have a synopsis for us.
Yes, so tonight we are covering the 1927 film Downhill. We're still going through kind of Hitchcock's early work, so I'm going to give you the tiny little synopsis from the Alfred Hitchcock Zone Wikipedia, but then I'm going to give you a bit of a deeper synopsis, and then we'll get some facts and then talk about the film. So, the very brief synopsis is thus. Public schoolboy Roddy Berwick is expelled from school when he takes the blame for a friend's theft, and his life falls apart in a series of misadventures. So that's kind of like the generic get him in to come and see it tagline. And then when we talk about the plot, so at an expensive English boarding school for boys, Roddy Berwick, played by Ivor Novello, is school captain and star rugby player. He and his best friend Tim Wakely, Robin Irvin, start seeing a waitress Mabel, Annette Benson. Out of pique, she tells the headmaster that she's pregnant and that Roddy is the father. In fact, it was Tim who cannot afford to be expelled because he needs to win a scholarship to attend Oxford University. Promising Tim that he will never reveal the truth, Roddy accepts expulsion. Returning to his parents' home, he finds that his father, Sir Thomas Berwick, Norman McKinnell, believes him guilty of the false accusation. Leaving home, Roddy finds work as an actor in a theatre. He marries the leading actress, Julia Fothingale, Isabel Jeans, after inheriting £30,000 from a relation. The unfaithful Julia secretly continues an affair with her leading man Archie, played by Ian Hunter, and discards Robbie after his inheritance is exhausted. He then becomes a gigolo in a Paris music hall, but soon quits over self-loathing at romancing older women for money. Roddy ends up alone and delirious in a shabby room in Marseille. Some soldiers come take pity on him and ship him back home, possibly hoping for a reward. Roddy's father has learned the truth about the waitress's false accusation during his son's absence and joyfully welcomes him back. Roddy resumes his previous life.
Excellent. And interesting, the offense at the school, is it the theft from the cash register or is it a fathering the illegitimate child? I think it's fathering the illegitimate child.
Yeah. That's what I think the thing in that they're like, oh, it's the, you know, the fact, oh, it's public disgrace, and, you know, at the time, you know, it wouldn't have been done and everything. So, and a lot of these schools still to this day, particularly in the UK, do have codes of conduct so that if, you know, you do something like this, then, you know, there is a chance for expulsion and everything, particularly in schools like, you know, Eton and Harrow and all that sort of thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, that's crazy.
Oh, well, to be fair, it really helps the kind of the teen pregnancy rate, so, you know.
Thank you for the synopsis, Chris. And, Brandon, you're going to give us your fact sheet.
I will go into the facts of the film. However, I may say a couple of times, please refer to a previous podcast, because rather than duplicating, because there's a lot of people that have worked on this picture that we've talked about on some of the previous podcasts. So I don't want to duplicate too much when we come across that, but I will still mention some names. So Downhill was released on October 24th, 1927 in the UK, and it was the third of three films that Hitchcock directed that was released in that year. The other two were The Lodger and The Ring that we previously covered. Now, the interesting thing about this one here is this was released on October 24th, and The Ring was released on October 1st. So these were actually released really, really close together. So I think that's interesting. Now, the original running time for the film in the UK was 80 minutes, and it had 6 minutes trimmed for the US release. The 2012 restoration was 105 minutes long. And now the Criterion edition that I watched on the Blu-ray for The Lodger, like this is actually included as a bonus feature on The Lodger Blu-ray, it clocked in at about 109 minutes. So now that 105 minutes is what I got from Wikipedia, and a lot of my information did come from Wikipedia here. Could be a little bit wrong, but the version that I watched was about 109 minutes long. Do you know how long the versions were that you guys watched?
I think mine was about the same, but the mine version didn't have sound, so...
Yeah, mine came in at an hour and 50 minutes, which makes it 110 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yep. Tom?
126.
Oh, wow. You might have had, like, a slowed version or something. I'm not sure, but yeah. So, yeah, there's lots of different versions out there. Yeah, Brandy, like, mine was, like, 110, but then there was, like, intro and stuff right. That I didn't count in that for, like, the BFI Film Institute and stuff like that. Now, the film was produced by Michael Balkin and C.M. Wolfe of Gainsborough Pictures. And for more on Gainsborough, please refer back to episode 5, where we covered The Pleasure Garden and The Mountain Eagle. Now, although Hitchcock had announced that he was leaving Gainsborough Pictures and had signed a 3-year contract with British National, and they would change their name to British International Pictures, he still had a few months left on his contract, and he didn't want to sit idle, so he actually made these films, this movie and The Ring in this period of time. So he got a chance to work with Ivor Novello a second time. Now, Downhill was a play written by Novello and Constance Collier. Now, they used the combined alias of David Lestrange to write this, and they had enjoyed a moderate success in the UK during 1926 with this play, partly due to Novello's sizable female fan base. And there's a scene in the play where he's, like, washing his bare legs on stage that the ladies just drooled over. And so Hitchcock actually tried to duplicate that in this film with his topless scene when he's spotted topless in the movie. Novello and Collier had previously collaborated on another successful stage play called The Rat, which had a film version that was directed by Graham Cutts for Gainsborough Pictures. Now, the interesting thing about Constance Collier, she was born Laura Constance Hardy in Windsor, Berkshire, and she made her stage debut at the age of 3, where she played Fairy Peasblossom in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And in 1893, at the age of 15, she joined the Gaiety Girls, the famous dance troupe based at the Gaiety Theatre in London. And she was a very beautiful woman and soon became so tall that she towered over all the other dancers. In addition, she had an enormous personality and considerable determination. In the late 20s, Collier relocated to Hollywood, where she became a voice coach and teacher in dictation. This was during the tumultuous changeover from silent films to sound, and many silent actors with no theater training were scrambling for lessons. She acted in almost 30 films, including a portrayal of Lady Macbeth in the 1916 film version, and she would work again with Hitchcock, however this time in front of the camera, in 1948 with her portrayal of Mrs. Atwater, the aunt of David Kentley, the murder victim from the film Rope. And that is Tom and mine favorite Hitchcock film.
Definitely.
So yeah, that's kind of interesting that they worked with this play that was written by her, and then she would be in a Hitchcock film later on. I love that. I think that's great.
That's cool.
Now, the film was adapted to the screen by Elliot Stannard, who we've spoken about several times in past episodes, and the film starred Ivor Novello, Robin Irvine, Isabel Janis, Ian Hunter, and Violet Fairbrother. We covered Ivor Novello in episode 7, where we covered The Lodger. And there's not a lot of information on Robin Irvine, who played Tim Wakely, the friend in the film. He died very young at the age of 31 on April 28th in 1933 in Bermuda. He would show up again in the Hitchcock film Easy Virtue before his death, and he would act in a total of 14 films. Isabella Jeans, who played Julia Fothengale in Downhill, was best known for her portrayal of Aunt Alicia in the 1958 musical film Gigi. She would work again with Hitch on the films Easy Virtue and Suspicion. Now, we spoke about Ian Hunter, who played Archie, in our last episode of Good Evening when we covered The Ring, and he will appear one more time with Hitchcock in Easy Virtue. And Violet Fairbrother, who played the poet, was an English film actress. She appeared in 25 films between 1911 and 1965, and she would appear in 2 more Hitchcock films, Murder and, you guessed it, Easy Virtue. So I'm going to be saying a lot of refer to previous episodes when we get to Easy Virtue, I think, as well. Now, one of my books that I use quite frequently when I'm reading and setting up my notes and whatnot is The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures by Donald Spotto. And in this book, Donald Spotto wrote that Downhill was a story remarkable mostly for its introduction of another mainstream Hitchcockian concern, that of guilt shared by two friends, a theme to be emphasized again and again from The Manxman through Strangers on a Train, Frenzy, and Family Plot. The opening title announces the tale of two schoolboys who made a pact of loyalty and one kept it at a price. Spotto also writes that technically, the picture is superior to just about anything that was made in England that year. There are perfectly matched dissolves to relate characters and themes, a fine dream sequence, and astonishingly stable follow shots with a handheld camera along the docks of Marseille. So, critically, and it's really well done, but guys, I gotta say, I had a hard time watching this film. Should we jump into the discussion of the film
now? Well, we've talked about the difficulty of watching silent film and how much work you have to do as a viewer to... You end up being a bit of a creative writer and filling in the dialogue that's happening, and you really have to pay attention. Brandy, how are you with silent films?
Well, I've seen my fair share of silent films. The original Phantom of the Opera is one of my favorites. But I noticed in this film, there were a lot fewer title cards and dialogue cards. It was, and I think that was probably purposeful. I didn't go into a whole lot of back research for the movie because I figured you guys were already going to cover that, which you did. Yeah. But I feel like that was a deliberate choice because you were supposed to be able to pick up on the visual cues of the characters instead of them having to give you every bit of dialogue in the movie on those title cards. And so let me just say, I had a fidget spinner nearby. I don't even know how I got into fidget spinners, but I'm just like, yep, I'm going to play with this for a bit while I'm watching it. And it actually helped me focus more. So hello, fidget spinners. Glad to meet you. Oh, I know why. It was because we get a Marvel subscription box and they stuck one in there in our last one. We're like, fidget spinner. And then we started playing with it. And oh, I get it now. Yeah. But yeah, it's silent movies are never what I would call easy to watch. And this one with the restored version is so long. Oh, it's so long.
I mean, at an hour and 50 minutes, that's not that long of a movie. But you are right, Brandy, and we've mentioned that a couple of times in the past couple episodes, that Hitchcock really is very sparse when it comes to his intertitles for his silent films. And he really is letting the viewer rely on the reaction shots. There was a couple of times when I could read the lips of what people were saying.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so he did a good job with that. But there's still a lot of, you know, long distance shots where you can't really make out what the people are saying. You just got to watch their actions. So,
Brandy and Chris, were you watching on YouTube?
Yeah, well, I did.
I did not. I actually got the official rental from Amazon Video and watched it in all its HD glory.
And Brandon, you were watching the high-definition re-release, the reissue?
Yeah, on the Criterion Blu-ray, yep.
So I had an interesting experiment. I found on YouTube a couple of different versions.
Yeah.
And I found one with no music, which had really good video.
That's the one I did.
I found one with music that had lousy video. Like, it was all boxed in, and, like, the heads were cut off. It was like when my mom takes a family photo. She
kept having
different
colored filters that would randomly appear over there. Yeah.
So what I did is I got tricky on my two. I have a double monitor, and on one monitor I watched the music version, and one monitor I watched the video version. So I kind of faked it, but I kept having to. They were different run times, so somehow they were losing sync with each other, and every 10 minutes I'd have to resync them. But you know, these are the struggles of being a highly intelligent film critic type. You know, these are the sacrifices we make, right? Like, but it doesn't make it accessible for the average viewer. Like, it doesn't, it makes it a challenge for people to watch these.
Next time you watch the version of the film with no soundtrack, you should try watching it with the soundtrack to Top Gun.
Yeah. I'll put on my Billy Idol Vital Idol remix CD.
Oh yeah.
Even
yeah,
better.
White Wedding, yeah. That'd feel great. Flesh with this.
Rebel Yell, let's get this going.
that could be an entire, like, what would that be, a mashup?
Oh podcast? My god, that'd be amazing. Oh my god, I love you so much. Highway to the Danger Zone.
Well, when they're getting married, you could have White Wedding on.
Yeah.
You know? It's a nice day for a white wedding.
Good times.
Oh.
So you were talking about filters earlier there, Chris. Yeah. So in the version that I had, it had a general sepia tone to it. When they went outside, it was basically black and white. However, I do got to say, when there was the dream sequence going on, it was in a bluish tint.
Yeah.
And I have to say that that really helped me to understand that what he was showing was a dream sequence.
Yeah. It does help. And the fact that, you know, like I said, it's in the 20s, and the fact they could use stuff like that rather than, like, hand-painting the film cells like they sometimes did, or, you know, that sort of thing, it does visually help. I think I basically put both of the versions that Tom mentioned into my little YouTube Watch Later playlist. Watch the second one first, because I thought, oh, it's shorter, that's fine, it's quicker. No, it's not, it's awful quality. And it just randomly switches, but I'm not talking like, oh, it's a bluish one to indicate this. No, sometimes it just had like a red, like a genuine just red overlay over it, and then it was like a green, and then there was like a yellow, and then there was a very like abrasive, unnatural kind of turquoise blue and all that sort of thing. So I think that might have been a bit of a dodgy version. I've said this with The Ring, and weirdly I think it shares a lot of similarities with The Ring, does Downhill, in the for a film as long as it is, the plot isn't that much, and it really stretches it out, because what it effectively boils down to is guy lies to protect another guy, goes on some misadventures. But it's not, it's for like an hour 40, it's really not that long, for like at least a 90-minute film. And it just, it dragged. And I think that's the thing, you know, you were talking about kind of what your issues were with silent films and that sort of thing. I'll be honest, if there's like a silent movie out there, and it's got a great plot, and there's plenty of stuff to like, so I can visually tell the story and understand it, that's absolutely fantastic, and I'll be more than happy to sit and watch that. But I'll be honest, it was the same or a very similar plot. It was all this kind of love triangle stuff, and Roddy kept getting involved in more love triangles, as with The Ring. And there was still, you know, this kind of, oh, it's all going to return to normal, everything. But there's nothing really won in either of them, really. And it just made me think, because these were done effectively back to back, and if you look at them as a weird pair, they do have quite a few striking similarities to them. So,
well, it's kind of like what Tom had said. We've mentioned several times over the last couple about how many triangle themes there are in these movies, right? And I every time we keep talking about the word triangle, I'm just getting a picture in my head of the jerk when he keeps running from those cans. He's like, "This guy hates cans," and I'm like, "This guy loves triangles," right? So I'm just like,
going from film to film.
Now, Brandy, I had texted you earlier. I said, without spoiling what I think of this movie, I said, all I'm going to say is, I don't understand 1927. So, what did you think when I sent that to you?
Well, I thought, well, I know a bit about the 20s, and in the States they were called the Roaring 20s, and that kind of filtered over into the UK as well. I don't know if it was as extreme as it was here, but it may have been more so because Britain had played a huge part in World War One, and they were, to steal a phrase, knackered. And they were also they were just ready to let loose and have fun. And oh boy, did they do that. And so the 20s were really racy. I mean, they were racy. You're thinking, oh my God, I was shocked. I was shocked when they showed a topless guy in a 1927 film. And then I remembered, oh, wait, it's the Roaring 20s. So I shouldn't be shocked at that at all, especially, you know, that same plot line of, oh, she's pregnant now and she's going to accuse somebody. And I just thought, wow, these are really advanced topics for that time in the 20th century. But the 20s were weird. They were weird, man. And it was all just building up to this giant collapse that became the Great Depression. So they were just living it up, and they lived it up a little too much.
I'm going to point out one thing here, though, is that, okay, so again, today we're recording. It's the 29th of October, 2017. And so this film debuted in theaters 90 years and 3 days ago. So like that we're is, like right yeah. on the 90th anniversary of this
wow.
as well. So, but what I meant that I didn't understand is, why is this guy taking the blame for his friend on this situation?
I agree. That's something that yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily a 1927 thing, but there's no background of why they're chums. There's no basis for this extreme loyalty, and we never see that friend again after he's expelled from school.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of, I just found that odd because it didn't seem to me like we had enough information to believe that friendship. But that's just me.
That was a bit of a stretch, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's how I feel about it anyway.
I don't know. That's kind of part and parcel of the old UK kind of thing. Weirdly, that kind of thing where it was like, oh, well, you know, he went, you know, he got himself expelled so his friend wouldn't get kicked out and everything. That weirdly does fit into a lot of our culture in a sense. So I didn't really find that kind of unbelievable. I get what you mean about kind of the lack, we didn't really see them.
Is it the schoolman's code? The code of the college?
Yeah, it's that whole
kind of brotherhood, the fraternity.
A little bit, yeah. It is similar to kind of how I'm guessing the Greek system works in kind of North America. Is like, oh, well, if you are kind of bonded to someone and you're like, kind of like the whole blood brothers thing, then you'll do anything to help them. And there is still, because he's, let's not forget, his dad was a sir, so money wouldn't have been an issue for him and getting kicked out and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But for his friend, it was. So it wouldn't have been a bit of like self-sacrifice. It would have been like, oh, well, I'll tell you what, I'll take the hit for this. You know, you're my brother, I'm supposed to protect you, and we look out for each other and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it does, it is a thing, weirdly enough. And so watching that, I was like, oh, okay, I don't necessarily agree with it, because you should take onus for your actions. But I understand mm-hmm. it. So, yeah.
See, what I could understand, and almost like if we were to remake this film nowadays, what I would see is that the rich friend would be the one who had the infidelity and caused the pregnancy, and the yeah. poor friend is the one who takes the blame and gets kicked out, but he says, look, you take the blame and I'll take care of you because I got a lot of money, and then, you know, just through the art of filmmaking and storytelling, he would just, you know, dismiss his friend rather than burden himself with paying for it all, you know? Like, I would see that being as a believable plot line rather than this rich friend taking the blame for this poor friend, you know?
Well, and I questioned that at first, too. But then when I was thinking about it after the fact, I thought, when he went home to tell his father what had happened, he expected his father to believe him and to not think that he actually had done what he'd been accused of. And then his father didn't believe him. And that's when it all started to go downhill. And you knew I was going to do that.
I know, that's awesome.
And it's so odd to me because I think about it, and he appears to be an only child. And so his father, of course, dotes on him, is very proud of him, etc. But why wouldn't he believe him?
Mm.
Why wouldn't yeah. he believe him? What's in the father's past that made him think? It just made me think there's something going on in that guy's past, in daddy's past, where he did something. He had some kind of indiscretion. And so he's thinking, well, I know what I was like when that I was that age, so he probably did do this. And now he's bringing shame upon our family.
So we need the prequel. We need the father's prequel. Yeah.
He stole some chocolates from a store in his past.
Yeah, that is what the world's been waiting for. Downhill 2, and it's like the prequel version. Yeah,
yeah.
Downhill 2, further down.
Yeah.
When we were getting ready for this show, I swore it was a film about skiing. I just didn't know.
Yeah,
well, that's what I thought. I had thought that too. Honestly, I'm like, I'm getting this. I'm like, these what? What's going on here? Where's the skis?
And the opening scene with the rugby match. I'm thinking, oh, it's a you know, it's all about athletics, and I thought it was going to be like a James Bond. Downhill, you know, helicopters and chasing down the mountain and stuff like that. But oh well,
it's a load of painted versions. Just like, look, he's going down a hill.
Can I go off track and do a bit of a trivia? You guys were talking about Ivor Novello and what a matinee idol he was, and how popular he was. There's an article.
Well, I was getting a little hot under the collar for him in this movie.
There was
He's
an article.
Fine. He is from, mighty fine.
From the day in October of 1927 from a magazine called Eve or a newspaper. And what they actually did at one of the performances was have Novello appear on stage during the film. So I'm going to read the clip from the article. As part of the film, the projection fades out and a curtain rolls up, and without breaking continuity, a scene from the play, as was done on the stage, is actually acted by Mr. Novello and his schoolboy friend. At the close, they are summoned to the head study, and the curtain goes down and the camera shows them walking the cloisters dejectedly. This is an effective screen device and gives Novello an opportunity of appearing in the flesh before his admirers. Can you believe that? Instead of actually just saying, oh, before the show, everyone come and say hi and have an autograph and say hi to Mr. Novello, they interjected a scene live into the film. That was a very elaborate stunt, and good for them. That would have been very rewarding for the viewer that was in the audience. You'll never see something like that today, though, of course.
Oh, no.
Unless you go to, like, Disneyland with, like, that Terminator 3D...
Wait, what? Terminator 3D at Disneyland? What?
It was right after Terminator. Oh, it was Terminator 2 3D or something like this. It was like some sequel that James Cameron directed that was a ride. I've never seen it myself, but he did this ride and it was in 3D. And I think people like came out as well and were like running around, but it wasn't even Novello or Schwarzenegger or anything.
But
like
at Disneyland?
May have not been. I don't know. I'm in Canada. What do I know?
That's a rated R movie, and I'm 100% sure that since Disney does not have anything to do with that film, they would not be promoting a ride.
Maybe
with
like
kids.
Universal Studios. Yeah, maybe
Universal. I'll believe.
Can I just say though, I would love to see the Disney version.
Right?
When it's like, you know, Snow White. Yes.
You're yes, not so white.
I am the Huntsman Terminator.
Yeah, Huntsman Terminator. He's there with like the axe, except it's a gun, and it's yeah. Sorry.
Yes.
If anyone steals this idea, I will be pissed.
Copyright October 29th, 2017.
Yeah. One more little production trivia thing I found really interesting. They got permission to film in the scene where Novello descends into the London Underground, into the subway. And he rides the escalator. They shot this at the Maida Vale Underground Station, but they could only film after midnight. So Hitchcock talks about how he went, back in those days, they went to the theater, and it was the opening night, so he was wearing a white tie, tails, and opera hat. So after the theater, after midnight, he went and directed this scene at the subway in a white tie and a top hat. He calls it the most elegant moment of direction he ever had.
Fair enough. Well, I'm
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say I've been to the opera in like a t-shirt and shorts, so it's a complete role reversal.
Yeah, that's...
T-shirt and shorts and a bag of Cheetos. Let's go to the opera.
Yeah, no, that's how people do it in Utah.
Marriage of Figaro!
Yeah, they show up to our swankiest new theater, which is big enough to house productions like... Hamilton is coming. Oh my lord, I'm never going to get tickets. But they will show up, you know, you'll see the older generation, you know, in nice dress, and then you'll see people in shorts and flip-flops, and it's just like, guys, you know the actors can see you, right?
Yeah.
But in any case, what I was going to say is that the escalator scene really, I think, starts to drive home the theme of the movie, which is... spiraling downhill.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're right. You get that same effect when he's being carried down into the ship as well. And basically the ship is like rock bottom. That's as low as he can go. And and the filter for that dream sequence in my version that I watched was actually green. It was a sickly green, I feel really fit well, especially since he was obviously delirious and feverish and unwell. And I feel like that really contributed to his physical and mental disposition at that point. And I will also say, it seems like nobody in this movie likes women very much.
Yeah.
Well, at least this guy doesn't. I mean, like, it's such a strange film because it's almost like three short films in the life of this guy.
Yeah.
You know, and the only connection between them is him. And there's similarities to The Ring as well that we discussed with this. You know, he marries this woman and she's still carrying on this infidelity with this previous person. But it doesn't end with that. I'm glad that she didn't come back and everything was okay and he stayed married to her at the end. I'm just glad that didn't happen. Yeah. But
sorry,
I don't know.
Just as you said about the three acts, it's like three things. This is really inappropriate, but in my head, I was just like, oh, it's like Moonlight, but crap. Because that's it. I'm just like, I was like, yeah, okay. But no, I completely agree in that it does almost feel just a bit like it could be. Like it could almost be like a three-part TV show in that it's like one episode, right, okay, so it focuses on his kind of school and then it's his marriage and everything and then it's his return and kind of coming full circle and everything like that. I mean, some of the directing was, in terms of like the angles and everything, I thought they were pretty good. And it was surprisingly like, I don't know how to describe it, but it was like surprisingly modern, I guess, or surprisingly like kind of clean shots and kind of well constructed. But I think the fact that I was focusing on that and not what they were saying or trying to say or even like intermittent, it's just, I don't know what Hitchcock had to work out of his system by doing like The Ring and then this back to back where it's all about like cheating adulterous partners. Or, you know, having these really negative portrayals of women where they're just like, oh, no, all they'll do is they'll cheat and they'll lie and they'll, you know, have affairs and they'll do all that sort of thing. Either that or they're, like, kind of simpering mother types and all that sort of thing. And I was just like, okay. I can't wait for him to kind of start, like, doing at least vaguely more fleshed out women, so...
Well, one thing, too, that's kind of interesting. Now, okay, so I don't... This wouldn't have been a consideration at all. Like, this is well prior to, you know, LGBT issues and transgendered issues and stuff like that. But at the end, when he's at that dance hall and he's talking one-on-one with that woman, like, was that a man dressed up as a woman? Like, to me, that was a man dressed up as a woman. And I'm just like, what is Hitchcock trying to say with this?
Oh my god! I'm gonna have to go back and look at that.
Now. It's the den of iniquity. Like the sun, they open the windows when the man is having the choking attack.
Yeah.
And they let all the fresh air in, and all the sunlight comes in, and then he looks around and he realizes, oh my god, there's all these horrible things going on. This is like a den of sin. Where have I landed? This is a bad place to be. And I think that character kind of reinforced that decadent. The Roaring Twenties, living on the edge, alternate lifestyle.
Yeah, you know. And I guess there was like that androgyny thing as well that came about. You know, in like the Roaring Twenties, a lot of the look was quite. There was a thing I read ages ago about kind of the look of the 1920s and everything, and it was kind of like the women were more masculine and the men were more effeminate, and it was that kind of androgyny thing. And then kind of from the 30s onwards, it became much more kind of like. This is what a guy looks like. This is what a woman looks like. They're very distinct things, and there's no kind of gender fluidity. So I don't know if it was maybe that, but I'm gonna have to rewatch that scene because I'll be honest, I do not remember any like potentially.
Yeah, in the version I had, to me, it looked like a man in like just a man with a wig on and a dress.
Right. Okay.
That didn't actually occur to me. I just thought it was sort of a woman with a. With some kind of hormonal problem, because she did have a bit of a mustache that you couldn't see until the windows were opened and there was sunlight, and then she looks very different. I don't know if that was purposely done to show that, you know, his vision had cleared when the sunlight came in, and now he was seeing things for what they were.
Well, that was definitely the point of that scene when they open. He brought in the light on this terrible situation of all these drunk people that he's in and stuff.
Yeah, well, and the fashion of the 1920s was very much where women were concerned. All the dresses were straight. They did not show the curves of a woman. You had to bind your breasts. Having big breasts was not a good thing. They wanted your pearls to hang straight down your chest. So it was very much all about not looking like a woman for whatever reason. But and maybe because women were finally starting to get the vote, that was something that they chose themselves, is to make themselves seem like they were on more equal footing. I wasn't there, I can't say. But it was the 20s fashion, both here in America and in the UK, was very much that straight look, flat-chested, and, you know, just don't look curvy. That was very, very taboo. Don't look curvy. Don't let them know that you're a female. Except from the neck up.
There was a lot of the Hitchcock camera devices, the first-person point of view happened a lot. Fairly modern photography, really. There was a lot of brandy, as in the alcohol.
Yep.
And there was a lot of alcohol. And there was a lot of spritzer bottles. The soda bottles, which...
that one shot where that Archie guy, like, it was, like, close up in the foreground, and then he pushed it. And then the reverse angle happened, and as he pushed it, it, like, pushed him away from the woman was the reaction shot. Like, there were some neat things in this film.
Soda bottles, you usually see them in slapstick, like in comedy. Like, hey, I'm going to soda you in the face with, you know, like, it, they were kind of a shtick in vaudeville, right? Again, very typical, simple service of alcohol. Brandy poured into a glass, a bit of soda, here's your drink. But there was a lot of drinking going on. Like, the whole point was that he fell into alcoholism. And also the stairs theme. Remember in Lodger, we talked about stairs and the escalator. There's a lot of stairs happening, a lot of climbing. Like Brandy mentioned, climbing into the belly of the beast of the boat, going downhill into the subway. There's a lot of that visual metaphor of climbing and descending.
So yeah, you pointed out the brandy. There was no Hitchcock cameo in this film either. But point out some of the brandy cameos. There was a lot of them.
In the movie, when the son goes home to his son, to his father's house, and the father comes in with his gentleman friend and he serves him a brandy. He serves him a cocktail. And when I call her the gold digger, the wife in Paris, with the apartment with her boyfriend, the leading man, they have a lot of alcohol, a lot of brandy sitting at that table. And you don't see beer, you don't really see wine, you see a lot of brandy. Or cognac, or whiskey, whatever, you know, it all kind of falls into the same category.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of really neat shots in this film, like, and a lot of off-putting things. Like, there was a few times when purposely by Hitchcock we were confused by what we were seeing. Like, that first transition, like, jump in time, when we see him, when we see Roddy again up in a suit and tie, and we think, oh, you know, maybe he's got his status back or whatever. Oh, but he's actually a waiter. Oh, look, he's stealing that woman's wallet. Oh, look, they're actually in a play, and he's an actor in a stage play and stuff. And it's really interesting, and it's, you know, it's offsetting, and you don't really know what's going on when you're watching the film because you're only being given this information visually a little bit at a time. So I really like that. I thought that was really interesting. And then afterwards, when he goes to give her the cigarette case back, and he says, you forgot it on stage again, she's, like, leaning back and upside down, and you see him upside down. You know, so that's a really neat shot. And then the first woman, which I can't remember her name, the one that was the waitress that got pregnant, you know, and they never did say the word pregnant, but they strongly implied what it was. When she's telling her story of what occurred, and like there was faded over top of the record spinning, and like there was like those multiple layers of image that we saw, and you know, like there's a lot of really, really good Hitchcock stuff in here, really good visuals.
Yeah, I do find it odd, though, that those guys were such good friends that they dated the same woman right in front of each other.
Yeah.
That was weird.
The note said, come to the candy shop after 6, I'll be alone. So you'd think he's going to show up alone, you know, because that's kind of what the note said. And then the two men show up, and I'm kind of like, awkward.
Weird.
Awkward.
But thinking about that, what I thought that meant was they were there to kind of give each other an alibi because they were in an upper class school so they could say, no, nothing bad happened. And the next thing we know, she's pregnant. And it's like, well, So were they doing it in the back room when he's selling that kid a candy?
No, I don't think it happened then because there was that whole focus on the shop closes at 1 o'clock on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
And later on when we see the two friends in their dorm room and he sees that sign and he gets so angry that he just like throws it off the table. So he knows. He already knows what's going on. He knows what he did. But he hasn't said anything about it to anyone else. So I think that's what happened. He started seeing her at the bakery after 1 p.m., and that's how that happened.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, I guess I could buy that. So, but still, it's just weird that, like, yeah, they were dancing. See, at first I got it that he was upset that his one friend was kissing her and that Roddy was upset that Tim was kissing her. But then it's like, I don't know. Just weird. Like, yeah, I don't date the same girls that my friends are dating.
There's a lot of temptation going on in that candy shop.
Yeah. Of many levels of temptation. I was more focused on the sweets myself. Yeah. I love
the idea that one of them walks up and they're like, oh, yes, there's temptation there. And you're like, yeah, the chocolate's really well priced.
Oh, so good.
Those were truffles.
See, and then they used, like, the visuals of, like, the way that I caught the visuals that Hitchcock was saying was that when they went to the flashback and he was handing her the money, my opinion is she's telling the story that they were paying her for sex.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got out of that visual. She's saying, yeah, they slept with me in the back and then paid me for my services. Even though what I got actually happened was that he accidentally pushed a button on the cash register and was paying her for that accidental thing because now her cash receipts would be out or whatever.
What happened was he was messing around behind the counter. The young boy, the little boy from the street came in and bought a big box of candy for a nickel, like paid, you know, way lower price than he should have. And the man was just messing with the till. And then the other five boys from the street all show up with their nickels or their... pardon, you know, their pence or their tuppence or whatever it is. And they want to buy these big boxes of candy. And it all was just kind of a farce. Like, I'm running the candy store and handing away candy. So that's why I paid the money, was to balance out for what chocolate had gone out the door. That's the logical, that's the real, like, the logical explanation. And then you're taking it into a metaphor, right, of what the transaction really was all about.
Well, no, because when she was telling the principal of the school, and they were cutting back to the visuals of what had happened, and you see again the money being transferred to her, and that's why I assumed she was telling him they paid me for sex.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that assumption, because that's what I got out of it as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was all about the low-priced candy.
Yeah, I wish I was that kid with a half penny and getting that big box of candy. Yeah.
Box of truffles.
It made my day.
Yeah.
Excellent. Right on. Well, I mean, I guess that's pretty about it. Do we have any other final thoughts that we want to say about Down Here?
I think we should all do our review out of five, where you have to invent what the unit is. Yeah. What was Brandon's a couple episodes ago was partially taxidermy puppies.
Oh, for the Bates Motel for episode 8?
For the ring, I said 3 out of 5 KOs or something like that. Yeah, so... But, Brandy, do you have any final thoughts on the film before we do that?
I am not sure I will ever watch this again. but I do not regret watching it. But it's not the kind of thing that, for me, you know, I can watch it. I feel like, oh, I need to watch Downhill today. I did enjoy seeing these scenes and these shots that really just made me think, oh, well, he was doing this so early in his career. And then when he got to the point where he was a big enough name, he just got to do this all the time. And so I appreciated the filmmaking that went into it. I appreciated Ivor Novello. I did enjoy looking at him. And that guy, wow, that guy was really amazing. I mean, he was not just an actor, he was a musician. And he composed a lot of songs for musicals and just so much. He was a big deal, and I just didn't even know. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to find more things that he's done, because I enjoyed him a lot.
Good Evening Podcast, where we watch the films so you don't have to.
Basically.
Sacrifice for the art.
So what would you give it as a rating, Brandy? Give me a funny rating.
I would give it 2.5 big boxes of chocolate out of 5.
Chris, final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Like one of those boxes of chocolates, it's very pretty and well constructed, but ultimately empty. So I am going to give it 2 out of 5 admonishing looks from Sir Thomas Berwick.
Yeah, this isn't a film that I'm going to rush to rewatch. I mean, stylistically and visually, there's a lot of things that are really neat in it, you know, but honestly, it wasn't a very good movie, and it's been my least favorite that I've watched so far, I think, out of all these, you know. I would say after this would be the Pleasure Garden for least favorite, right? And then The Ring, and then The Lodger at the top for the movies that we've watched. But you know, we don't have many more silent films. We've got 4 more silent films to cover. I'm eager to get to his sound era. You know, I'm eager to, because it's hard watching silent films. And, you know, I don't watch a lot of silent films. So I'm glad that Brandy says that with Hitchcock, it's not common that there's not a lot of intertitles. I think that's interesting. And I'm looking forward to maybe checking out some more silent films when we're done this. But I think 1 a month is about all the silent films I can handle right now. So, yeah, I'm gonna give this film a rating of 2 out of 5, you know, 50 franc dances.
Dancing with a guy named Frank? What? I agree. Like, it was, you know, we were watching these films for the purpose of doing the podcast. And it's not, you know, it is a bit of a chore, a bit of a challenge. I enjoyed the film, but yeah, I'm not going to rush back to watch it again. And going with the I think everyone's getting pretty much the same rating. I'll give it a 1 seltzer bottle, 2/5 full of soda. And that would be my rating for this film.
2/5 bottle of seltzer. I mean, the Blu-ray transfer that I watched was beautiful. Mm. Like, outstanding quality. Like, just the detail in the film was just beautiful. You know, if you're a fan of Hitchcock, you got to see it. If you're just a casual fan, you can miss it. You're not missing too much here.
Yeah, so. Can I change mine to 2.5 hirsute women? Because box of chocolate's just too common.
It's a good thing it's Halloween weekend, because we have a lot of chocolate in the house right now. So,
oh yeah, me all too. This, all this me temptation. Too. I'm trying not to get into it.
I need chocolate.
All this temptation.
It's National Chocolate Day here in the States.
Oh, so. Congratulations. Oh. Happy.
Yeah.
I thought that was yesterday, and that's why they made it Deanna
Troy. Every day is National Chocolate Day, Brandon. Deal with it.
I think it's yesterday.
That's my opinion. Yes.
What on earth
yes.
is a caramel?
Oh, man.
I'll mail you some.
No, because I will eat them. I'll be like...
They'll be all melted.
It's chocolate with caramel on the inside.
What's a what?
Wonderbar.
Wonderbar.
We're introducing
Wunderbar.
On camera.
Wunderbar.
We're sharing Wunderbar. Canadian chocolate brands.
I'm learning so much about the Canadian chocolate.
Have you ever had Oh, there's a camera there. Crispy Crunch.
Crispy Crunch.
Nope.
See...
That one's got peanut
that's
butter
the best
in
thing
it.
About the best thing about Halloween is, like, well, I just ate 5 chocolate bars. But they're tiny. They're little, so it's okay. They're only that big, right? So
yeah, there's that old joke in the UK. They're called fun size, or I don't know if they're called fun size in North America. And they're like, they're not so fun when you've eaten a whole bag of them. Yeah, yes, we've got Smarties. Yeah,
oh, we have Smarties too, but they're different.
Like this box of chocolates, our podcast is full of Smarties.
Ah,
hey.
Well, on the next episode of Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, we're going to dive into 1928. Now, Hitchcock had 3 films that year as well, and the first one is called The Farmer's Wife. So that'll be our next film that we're going to be covering if you want to watch along. And again, so we've got 4 more silent films. There's Farmer's Wife, Easy Virtue, Champagne, and The Manxman. And then we're going to get into his sound era. And when we cover Blackmail, which is his first sound film. We've tentatively reached out to film critic David Cairns in the UK, and so we're going to hopefully get him on. He's done some writing for Criterion and some of their liner notes and stuff for their DVDs and Blu-rays. So we're very hoping that goes through. We told him it was going to be February or March before we get to that, but we're looking forward to having him on for this first sound film. Brandy, thank you for joining us. I'm glad to have you.
It's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed myself.
Where can people find you when you're not, you know, taking the blame for impregnating your friend's women?
Oh, man, I'm telling you, it's been a hard life, but I'm going to come out on top someday. Well, you can find me on Twitter as Brandywine12, which is BrandiWine12. And I do a podcast with my husband called The Dark Corner Podcast, where we talk about mostly anything we want, but it's usually pop culture through a darker lens. That one is not for children because I have a potty mouth. And also, I...
Chris is really giddy. He's like,
this
is,
I'm like, oh my God, this sounds amazing.
We have a good time. And I'm also on the Trek FM network. I do a podcast with Bruce Gibson called Live from the Edge, where we do our reactions after an episode of Star Trek Discovery has aired. And when Star Trek Discovery comes back in January, that will be on Monday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. You can find that on the Trek FM YouTube page when it happens, and then it's released as a podcast on Tuesday morning. And so look for that when Discovery comes back.
Chris, where can people find you when you're not charging 50 francs a dance with old, unattractive ladies?
Aww. When I'm not busy being impregnated by public school boys on rugby scholarships, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. Aside from Good Evening, I also do a podcast with one of my best mates, Emma Platt. We do a podcast called North by Nerd West. It is very nerdy, very unfiltered. We talk about whatever the hell we want to talk about.
Yes.
Often very rambly. We'll just start and be like, we're going to talk about this. And then 20 minutes later, it's like, nope, we've just been talking about Harry Potter for 20 minutes. Nope, it's not going to work. Our Halloween special, which is like ridiculously long to make up for the fact we've not had a regular episode in a little while, came out today, so you can find that. Our Halloween Spectacular is now on iTunes. Please listen to all of the other episodes, review, subscribe. If you like kind of nerdy stuff and people just laughing and having a good time, then please listen to that.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not blowing your 30,000 pound inheritance on a woman who doesn't really love you?
I ain't saying she's a gold digger. I'm on Instagram as the Tom Caldwell, and bowing to pressure from Brandon, I joined Twitter. I think I'm up to like five tweets now. Anyway, I have no idea what I'm doing. As Tom Caldwell 3000, shout out to Andre 3000 and Outcast for the inspiration for my nickname.
Excellent. And I need a funny one. Somebody give me a funny one here.
When you're not too busy being delirious, being rescued from France by a load of British sailors.
Where can you find me when I'm not, when I'm not doing that?
When you're not,
where can I find you when you're not delirious, Brandon?
When you're not going downhill, Brandon.
Yeah.
When you're not sleeping on the bunk that many a sailor has shared.
That sounds like a euphemism, my God.
Excellent. You can find me over on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and you can find me on the Trek FM network with The Edge, where I'm actually the host of the main show, and you can find me on Trek FM as well with Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast. And you can, where else can you find me? I think that's pretty much it. That's about it. So,
you can usually find me at the candy shop. At the candy shop.
At the candy shop.
Buying boxes of truffles for a nickel.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody. That was a really good show. Congratulations to us on our 10th episode. Thank you, Brandy, for joining us.
I had a great time.
You brought a ray of sunshine to our program. Thank you for being here.
Oh, well, thank you. You should see me with makeup on.
And as we traditionally like to close the show, Thank you for joining us, and good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Cool. Any questions before we start?
What's the name of the show? Good evening.
Good evening, and Alfred Hitchcock podcast.
I'll read it off your t-shirt. Nice t-shirt, by the way.
Yeah, Chris doesn't have his on. Thanks a lot, Chris. Way to, like, not support the show.
Okay, you know what? I wore it last time, and it's in the wash, so...
Give the guy a break.
Judge me all you like.
Hey, I don't care if it's clean or not. I can't smell you from here.
No, but I can, and that's the issue.
Oh, okay.